tonight, you have in front of you this green sheet. This sheet, if you kind of glance at it from the top left corner to the bottom right, what this is going to do is it's going to cover chapter 6, the end of chapter 19 in the book of Revelation. This is going to be a survey. Before we go any further in Revelation, what I want you to see is roughly how the book of Revelation works from this point out. Because up to this point, we know that we have a three-part outline for the book of Revelation. Where would you, if somebody asked you, if you told them the book of Revelation, most of it is talking about future events, how would you show them the three-part outline of the book of Revelation? Where would you go? You remember?
It says these things, and then after these things. And
that'd be Revelation 1:19.
Revelation 1:19 gives you the rough outline. Okay. Nope, that was what I was looking for. The general rough outline is the things that you've seen, the things that are, and the things that shall come to be after this. And then if you go to the first verse of Revelation 4, then you see that from Revelation 4, you're all talking about the things that come to be afterwards. So the church is the things that are. The vision of Christ in chapter 1 are the things that John had seen. And from Revelation 5 or 4 on, you're talking about future events. It's all future. We've looked at chapters 4 and 5 because they kind of give us an overview of a picture or a scene in heaven at the beginning of Daniel's 70th week. This chart then is going to take us from chapter 6 down to chapter 19. And what I want to do is we're going to fill in some details along this. And this is a fill-in-the-blank worksheet here for you to kind of get an overview of what's going on. And I've attempted to account for all the scripture passages. Now, there was one oversight in the copying of this from my handwritten copy that I made for myself. And I thought I'd caught it last week, but I realized looking over it this week that no, I still didn't catch it right. We'll point that out when we get there. So we're going to start in chapter 6. And I am not going to be reading a ton of different verses tonight because we're going to save that as we begin going through the book. But I want to try to hit some highlight verses to kind of give us some framework. Okay? Because sometimes it is helpful to have a little bit of a framework of how things go. Because a lot of people think, and this is why we're doing this, a lot of people think that Revelation starts at this point, and then it's this event, and 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 this event, then the end. And what you find, if you just pay attention, you don't have to be a Greek scholar to do this. Even if you read an English Bible and you pay attention, you can see that there are sections of this book that overlap other sections. And really, if you kind of even look at the overview here, what you see is this book follows themes. It chases themes is what it does. So we start with chapter 6, and begin with verse 1, it says, And I saw, and the Lamb opened one of the seven seals, and I heard one of the four living beings say, with the sound of thunder, come, and I looked, and there was a white horse, and its rider had a bow, and there was a crown given to him, and he came out conquering and to conquer. And what you have, beginning in chapter 6, beginning with verse 1, down through, if you look in verse, let's see which one I want to go to here, to actually catch this. I'm missing number 6 in here. I see 5 and I don't see 6.
Verse
12
is the
CC. Oh, I did have verse 12. Okay, I was looking right at it and I keep seeing. Oh, there it is, 6. It's over in the margin, which is what I'm not seeing. It's down in the crease of my Bible. I saw, and he opened the sixth seal, and a great earthquake occurred. Now, we will go through all those in detail, so don't get impatient. We're not going through them tonight, because I'm giving you an overview. So what you have in verses 1, technically down through verse 17, is we have the breaking of seals 1 through 6.
We need to write that on the line.
Yeah, and so under that line where it says 6, 1 through 17, on that line, you have breaking of seals 1 through 6. Now, Now it jumps ahead on the outline if you look, and you might put a little bit different heading or something there, but that's roughly what I have. And then if you jump ahead to chapter 8 and verse 1, look at chapter 8 and verse 1. Chapter 8 and verse 1, and where these lines are, there's one other thing I want you to see on the outline. Hopefully you see this. Across the top, we have 3.5 years, then we have midpoint, and then we have 3.5 years. So with that, where those lines go, what we're seeing is that those lines are indicating the time frame where these events are going on. If you look at 8:1, it says, "And when he opened the seventh seal, there was silence in heaven for a half an hour. And then he saw seven angels who were stood before God, and they were given seven trumpets." So 8:1 is seal number seven. We're not going to explain what seal number seven is. You can see it there. It was half hour of silence, but we're not going to explain that tonight. Okay. So seal number seven is under 8:1. Then if you go over to 8:2 through 9:21, what you're going to have, in very simple terms, you could see it in 8:2, that there were seven angels and they were given seven trumpets. And in those verses, 8:2 through 9:21, we have trumpets numbers 1 through 6, not 1 through 7. Again, there's a break before we get to number 7, and we'll deal with that in just a second. So we have trumpets 1 through 7. Or 1 through 6. That is over on the right-hand side. It says 8:2 through 9:21. Yeah, and that's trumpets numbers 1 through 6. Now I want you to jump back to chapter 7. In chapter 7, right after the sixth seal, before seal 7 is broken, which is at the beginning of chapter 8, we already saw that. And remember, John didn't write with chapters. But these are places where the chapter divisions are helpful because they do kind of break around some of the major divisions in the book in terms of just clustering thought together. But if you look down here in chapter 7, and it says in verse 1, "And after this I saw four angels having taken their stand on the four corners of the earth. They were holding the four winds of the earth so that the wind should not blow upon the earth, neither upon the sea, neither upon the tree. And I saw another angel coming up from the rising of the sun, having a seal of the living God, and he cried with a great voice to the four angels to whom it was given to harm the earth and the sea." And when you look at the trumpets, that's what the trumpets will do. The trumpets will harm the earth and the sea, saying, "Do not harm the earth or the sea, nor the trees, until we have sealed the slaves of our God." By the way, here's another good place to see that the slaves of our God is a reference to Israel. Okay? Never is a reference to the church. Paul looked at himself as a slave, but not a church. I've got to stay on track or we will never get through this tonight. "Till we have sealed them upon their foreheads." Verse 4, "And I heard the number of the ones having been sealed, 144,000 sealed from every tribe of the sons of Israel." And then you have the sealing of them down through verse 8. So 1 through 17, and the reason we have down 1 through 17, we're going to have another group that's going to be involved here, and we've kind of singled them out over on the right-hand side. But what we have here, if you just want to mark that line, is these 144,000 Jews are sealed at this point. Now, we don't know what they're sealed for yet. We know that they're sealed. We don't know how long they're sealed for, but we know that they're sealed. Okay. Now, over on
that line, sorry,
that whole line that goes all the way through there.
So it happens right before the midpoint.
Right before the midpoint. We're going to explain why it happens right before the midpoint in a little bit. Okay? Why it happens then. But we can't now because I'm trying to follow these verses through here, and hopefully we'll explain it in just a bit. Okay.
Can I ask one other question about
Yes.
it? Do all 144,000 make it into the community?
Yeah. They are sealed to protect them. Yes.
Thank you.
Yep. Now, if you look over on the right-hand side, under that line, we have 7, 9 through 17, which if you look at verse 9, it says, "And after these things I saw, and behold, there was a great crowd, which no one was able to number, out of every nation, tribe, people, and tongue, standing before the throne and before the Lamb, having been clothed in white robes." It's a different Anyway, I'm not going to teach on this. We're just staying on track. I want you to look down. We find out what these people are when we go down to verse 14, because John wants to know who these people are, and it says, I have said to him, Lord, or I said to him, Lord, or my Lord, you know, and he said to me, these are the ones coming out of the literally great tribulation. So these people are actually people that are going to come out the end of the great tribulation. That's why that line extends past the end of the box over there. You see that? Because it shows that these are people that come out of the great tribulation. They've washed their robes, and they have made them white by means of the blood of the Lamb.
And so these are tribulational saints?
They are tribulational saints, but they are Gentile saints. They're distinct from the Jews because they're from every tribe, people, nation, and tongue. That's it. Trib. I was writing off my pen. It was getting hard to reach the edge of it just right. So it's Gentiles. What you see in 7, 9 through 17, or you see Gentiles, this is what I put it down, Gentiles exiting the trib. That's short version of it. But that means that they had to be saved during that last half of the tribulation. And I'm just going to say this now. I believe the reason they're named at that point is it shows you what the 144,000 were. We're going to find later that they're ones that had the testimony of Jesus. What they did with that testimony is that they reached this innumerable company of Gentiles during the last half of the tribulation period. That's why these guys are in somewhere in the last half. I don't know. You could put that line all the way back to the beginning of that last 3.5 years. But I just tried to make sure you understood they're going to be as a result of the work of those people.
Can I ask one other question? I know you're doing a...
No, that's all right.
This is good stuff. If you look at the context there of 15, 16, and 17, it looks like it's a pretty positive message. There will be hunger, thirst, sun will beat against them. So I would take this as that this is at the very end.
That's why they're exiting, yeah.
So this is the very, very end.
Because they're going out into the millennial kingdom.
Okay.
And in the millennial kingdom, then they're going to hunger, thirst, the sun's not going to beat down on them anymore. Right. Yeah.
But some of those Gentile tribulation saints will die and will make it.
Exactly, yeah. And you're going to meet some of those people at other points in the book. Exactly. Now, you notice over there on the right-hand side, because we're going to move down there a little bit, there's no chapter 8 because we already dealt with that up above. Because you went from the seals to the trumpets. And then if you turn to chapter 9, we're going to cover some of chapter 9 because I want to single out what happens in 9. We have three things there. We have 9, 1 through 12. We have 9, 13 through 10, 11, and we have 11, 14. You see those three listed over there on the right-hand side? Now those are, if you look in chapter 9 and verse 1, 9:1, it says, and the fifth angel trumpeted. Notice this is the fifth angel now. So when we're at 9, 1 through 12, we're at the fifth trumpet. The fifth angel trumpeted. By the way, let me see if you can do this and see how well you can count. If you have 7 and you're at number 5, that would be this one, how many trumpets do you have? 5, 6, 7. That's how many? 5, 6, 7. What is that? That's 3. Okay. I want you to get the 3. Because if you follow through, that trumpet that is blown in verse 1, that extends down through verse 12. And notice what it says in verse 12. The first woe is past. Behold, yet two woes come after these things. So trumpet number 5 is also woe number 1. And that's what I actually have over there. Woe number 1. You could put it woe number 1 equals trump 5. Okay? And as I said, we will deal with those in detail when we go through there. If you look at the next one in verse 13, it says, and the sixth angel trumpeted, and I heard a voice from the four horns. And if you look down in chapter 10, and in verse 11, that's not it. Which one am I supposed to have here? 9:13. I'm sorry, I'm sometimes inept with this. Okay, let me look at my other sheet here for a second. I'm looking for woe number two. I want you to see that it's woe number two. Seeing if I can find them listed here on my other sheet.
Second was past 11:14.
11:14. Oh, maybe that's my problem. Oh, I have 11:14 down there. Okay, and I have it. I don't have it marked right. So second woe is past. So the second woe includes, and there's a lot of other things that go on in there, which we're going to, I'm going to step back and I need to explain this now here in just a second. What? That should be woe number two. Woe number two is trumpet number six, is trump six.
You don't have the right verses because 10:11 is not right.
Yeah, it should be 10:14, yeah.
There is no 10:14.
Or 11:14, yes.
But that's underneath. You got it wrong.
There is a reason for that. And I know what it is. Okay. See, this is my problem. I left a section out, and I have it right here penciled in, or penned in. Woe number two involves that event, but there's another event that goes in between there, and it involves, and this is what I've totally missed, in 10:1 through 11, you have seven thunders, okay, that are mentioned in chapter 10, right? Chapter 10, you actually have seven thunders that are going to come out.
There's, and that goes between 9:13 and 11:14.
Yes, and that is 10:1 through.
Right.
Yeah, and I think it encompasses. I think the seven thunders, in reality, I think they encompass woe number two, and I think they have a relationship to trumpet number six. But if you wanted, What I did with mine is I just put an arrow underneath here, and then over here on the side in this middle section where I had room to write, I wrote
the sixth trumpet is the second woe, and it includes the seven thunders.
Yeah, or at least has a relationship to the seven thunders. Yeah. The second woe is the seven thunders as well as trump number six. In other words, the woe includes all of that. Exactly.
Okay, so
the second woe is the seven thunders and trumpet number six. See, and it's because I left that out, that's why this doesn't make sense over here. And I've got it written in the middle here, and I'm not paying attention to it.
So at 9:13 and that 10:1-11, they kind of go together.
They do, yes, because that's woe number two. That all covers woe number two. Yes. Now, there's one other thing that I want you to see in here, and that is when you get to the first part of chapter 11. And this explains this. In chapter 11, and if you look, I want you to go to verse 3. We'll go to 11, verse 3. That's the one I have marked here. It says, "And I will give my two witnesses authority, or I will give to my two witnesses that they would prophesy for," now this is important, "for 1,260 days. Now what does 1,260 days come out to?
3.5 years.
3.5 years. Now not if you're calculating it by a year as we know it, because how many days in a year do we have?
365.
But if you were living in 360 is the year that the Jews operated on, because remember that the Jews had, what? It connects with Daniel, yeah. It ties it in very clearly with Daniel. So, now what that tells you, so if that's 3.5 years, what it's telling you is that those two witnesses minister for how long? 3.5 years. They prophesy for 3.5 years. We're going to tell you who these witnesses are, or at least what they're doing. I don't know if we can put our finger and identify them. A lot of people want to. But what I want you to see with those witnesses is that when we come to, and this is important for us, go to verse 11. And in verse 11...
11 or 11?
11, 11. 11, 11. We have the two witnesses. What you find if we keep reading through is that these two witnesses, they minister for 3.5 years. At the end of their time that they're serving or prophesying, they're killed. They are killed by the beast. Their bodies lay, it says in verse 11, and after 3.5 days, the spirit of life from God entered into them. They stood up on their feet, and great fear fell on all them that were seeing them. And I heard a great voice out of heaven saying to them, come up here. And they went up into heaven in a cloud, and their enemies saw them. This isn't going to be a secret rapture. They're snatched up, and the people who have celebrated their deaths are going to watch these guys raised from the dead and watch them go up into heaven. And verse 13, and in that hour. Now, you always have a question. We come to the word hour, and we'll deal with this more in more detail when we get there. But when we come to the word hour, sometimes hour refers to a shorter period of time than a day, and sometimes an hour is a little hour, literally an hour on the watch. And we're going to have to interpret when we get here whether he's talking about in the absolute very hour, 60-minute time frame in which these guys were caught up, that this, or in a short space of time. Now, I'm inclined in this context to probably take it within the 60-minute time frame. But I also realize, and you all would agree, that there are places, if we looked at it, places where the word hour occurs, and it doesn't refer to 60 minutes. Okay, it's referring to a larger piece of time than 60 minutes, but shorter than what the Bible would normally call a day. Okay, but it says, in that very hour, verse 13, a great earthquake occurred, and a tenth part of the city fell. And that city, by the way, is Jerusalem. And there were killed in the earthquake the names of men of names, literally, that is people of some significance or reputation, 7,000, and the rest became afraid and gave glory to the God of heaven. Verse 14 now says, the second woe is past, behold, the third woe is coming. In other words, that has to do with the sixth trumpet. So it extends that far, which is why we have it going that far. Then when we come to verses 11... 15 and following, we're actually in the third woe now from what he said. And it says in verse 15, and the seventh angel trumpeted, and there were two loud voices in heaven saying. Now this is important because it tells you what the trumpet is. The kingdom of the world. Doesn't say kingdoms. I think there's a reason it doesn't say kingdoms. Because at this point, God's looking at all of humanity as being joined and massed together in revolt against God. And he doesn't see them as separate entities, but he sees them as a united kingdom. Yeah, and it's no.
It says kingdom is singular?
Yeah. We'll go through this in detail when we get there, okay? Yeah. But that's what we're talking about. But I want you to see that the kingdom of the world has become the kingdom of our Lord and of his Christ, and he will reign into the ages of the ages. And then we have the shouts and the statements of some other believers. But what we're having then at 11:15, we have trumpet number 7. And trumpet number 7 is the second, the third woe, but it also is the second coming. The second coming is the third woe. Well, think about it.
So 11:14 is woe number 3.
Brings on or sets up for woe number 3, yeah. And then 11, yeah. Yeah, that's just fine. Just put it down.
Trumpet number 7, and
return of Christ for 11:15. Yeah. No, 11:15 under here is.
What's 11:14?
Well, just leave it.
The second.
See, I'm practicing trying to do this with you guys.
So 11:14 is the second woe is past.
The second woe is, yeah.
It delineates that it's the end of it, right?
It's the end of woe, yeah.
The question is, what earthquake? Because there's two great earthquakes, so it'd probably be the one where the islands disappear.
But this is one that shatters Jerusalem, and it happens in connection with the second coming. So it may involve Christ putting his feet on the Mount of Olives, which is to the east of Jerusalem, and cleaves, remember, the Mount of Olives from east to the west. Well, if you're going to cleave the Mount of Olives, which sits right out there on the east side, it's just going to go right through the city, and it's going to cause an earthquake in the city, which is going to cause at least a tenth of the city to fall. So that's the earthquake that I connected with here at this point. Okay. So 11:15, 11:14, I have down as woe number three. That's what I have, because it says woe number three is coming. I have 11:15 as trumpet number seven and the second coming. Okay. That's the way I have these listed at this point.
But 11:14 is just woe number three.
Yeah, or introduction to woe number three, because it says, well, it says, the second woe is past, behold, the third woe comes quickly, and the third woe then will be 11:15, is where it's going to come in. Now, see what you can see, if you followed this, what we've done is we've seen that the book of Revelation in chapter 6, 1 through 17, through chapter 11, verse 15, we've gone from the beginning of Daniel's 70th week to the end of Daniel's 70th week in those chapters, if you paid attention. Now, there's a number of people don't do that. They come to trumpet number 7 and they say trumpet number 7 introduces the seven bowl judgments. But it doesn't say it introduces the seven bowl judgments. What it actually says is that the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of His Christ. When does that happen? When Christ comes back. See? That's when it happens. So that is the end of the tribulation. Okay, but at this point, all of those statements, everything that we've looked at, and we're going to deal with it. Who was sealed in chapter 7? 144,000 Jews. Where do the two witnesses prophesy?
In
Jerusalem. What city's destroyed at the end? Jerusalem. If you begin to see this, these chapters 6 through chapter 11 primarily look at the tribulation in terms of how it affects Israel and how they're involved specifically. Now, it's not that they don't have any relationship to the next sections, but that mostly focuses on them. Now, chapter 12 is going to back up. Except chapter 12, interestingly enough, when it starts, it's going to go back. And you don't have this if you look where it says 12, 1 through 5, and you see that dog leg that goes up above and off to the left. What my printer cut off is that there's supposed to be an arrow extending out of the box. And it should go off the side, out of the box, pointing out this way. And the reason for that is because 12, 1 through 5 actually is even before our time. And we'll see that in just a second. But beginning in chapter 12, down through chapter 19, we are going to see God's systematic destruction of Satan's system. In other words, 6 through 11 address God's systematic address of the nation of Israel. That really is addressing Daniel's 70th week, bringing those things to an end. But Israel is not the only issue in Daniel's 70th week. According to Daniel, it is, but there are also other things that have to be dealt with, and one of them is the world system. And that's where chapter 12 through chapter 19 primarily come in, where God's going to be dealing with Satan's world system. So if you look in chapter 12. Does anybody have questions at this point before we jump into chapter 12? Are you following this or is this a conundrum?
No, it's good.
Okay, good. You're doing okay over here. Good. So chapter 12, verse 1, and I saw a great sign. A great sign was seen in heaven. There was a woman having been clothed with the sun and the moon under her feet, and on her head a crown of 12 stars, which, by the way, that goes right back to a dream. Who is the great dreamer?
Joseph.
There's a dream that Joseph had that relates directly to that. So if you're familiar with Genesis, that makes perfect sense. In verse 2, and in her womb she had a child, and she cried out with birth pains, being in pain to give birth. And it says in verse 3, and there was another sign that appeared in heaven. Behold, a great dragon with 7 heads and 10 horns and 7 diadems on his heads, and his tail swept down a third of the stars of heaven, and he threw them to the earth. This is where we derive the idea that Satan took a third of the spirit beings with him. That third of them agreed. Then the dragon stood before the woman who was about to bear a child, so that he might devour her child as soon as it was born. And she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all nations with a rod of iron. Who is that?
Jesus.
Jesus Christ. Now, of course, we ask the question, who's the woman? And while a lot of people go, well, it's Mary. Actually, if you follow what it is, the woman is representing Israel. And what he's saying is exactly what Paul says in Romans 9. Mm-hmm. What is Israel? It is where this Christ is from. And that is that goes back to Joseph's dream and things like that. So it's we're not twisting it and going, well, why isn't it Mary? Well, because in reality, what he's going to end up saying about this woman doesn't fit Mary. So it's
the, really Jacob in Israel. Isn't it?
Yeah, it's looking at the nation of Israel. Exactly. With a rod of iron, he's going to rule them. But it says her child was snatched up to God and to his throne. And the woman, verse 6, fled into the wilderness where there was a place prepared for her to be nourished by God. Now stop there. What that shows you is that the woman can't be Mary, because when was her son ever taken away from her and then she fled off into the wilderness to a place prepared for her by God? Not. So what you find is that this woman, at this point, has a reference to the nation of Israel. But notice
well,
what it's...
The Catholics probably say she went to Egypt.
Well, they might, but Jesus wasn't snatched up away from her when she went to Egypt.
Yeah.
Or before she went to Egypt. But then notice what it says at the end of verse 6. That she is nourished there, notice what it says, for 1,260 days. The end of verse 6, you see? So again, that fleeing to the wilderness is taking place when? For 3.5 years. When for 3.5 years? You and I don't know yet. We don't know, are we talking about the first 3.5 years, or are we talking about the second 3.5 years? Well, actually, what you have to do is you then look in verse 7. It says, and there was a war in heaven. Michael and his angels went to war. We're not going to go through all of this in detail, but what happens is Satan loses. He is cast out. And when he is cast out, it says in verse 13, chapter 12, 13, so when the dragon saw that he'd been thrown down to the earth, he pursued the woman who had given birth to the male child. And the woman was given two wings of a great eagle. By the way, that's interesting, because remember there was a verse in the Old Testament that says, they that wait on the Lord shall renew their strength, they shall mount up with wings like eagle. That is not hyperbola, and that is not a verse for you and I. That was talking about Israel waiting for the return of their Messiah. Doesn't mean you wait on the Lord in prayer. If you make it that, you actually are allegorizing it from what it means. It makes it very clear if you read over there, they're waiting for their Messiah to come. They're not waiting in prayer. Anyway, I'm getting into this more than I want to there. But it says, he pursues her. The woman is given two wings of a great eagle so that she could fly from the serpent into the wilderness to her place where she is nourished. So that flight, we're jumping back up to the verse earlier in the context. This is her flight where she's going to be nourished. And here it says, where she's nourished for time, times, and half a time. What book of the Bible would your person go to find the idea of time, times, and half a time? What Old Testament book?
Daniel.
Daniel uses that expression of time, times, and half a time. So if you were a Jew, you'd be familiar with this and you would understand that he was talking about this event that Daniel had talked about. And she flees into the wilderness at this point. And she flees when or after Satan has lost his fight and he goes out there into the wilderness. And next thing, verse 15, I have to keep catching my place here. And then from his mouth the serpent poured out water like a river after the woman to sweep her away with a flood. But the earth came to help the woman. It opened its mouth, swallowed the river that the dragon had poured from his mouth. And then the dragon was angry with the woman, went off to make war with the rest of her children. Now, what's the rest of her children?
144,000.
It's 144,000. It says, those are the ones who keep the commandments of God. They have the testimony of Jesus. See, we were talking about that. That's why you have that innumerable company of Gentiles that are saved. And he took his stand on the sand and sea. So in other words, we know when those guys were sealed. Those guys were sealed after the first six seals, right? That's the remnant. He goes after them, which means that this war that he got kicked out of has to happen after the sixth seal. And by the way, that tells you where the seventh seal comes. The seventh seal is the war in heaven, because as we've said before, when men fight, we clang swords, we shout, we blow things up, we make a lot of noise. But when angels fight, which are spirit beings, and they don't have swords, and they don't have cannons, they don't have bazookas, when they fight, it's silent. So that half hour of silence, I really think the best way to understand it, that is the battle in heaven between Michael and his angels and the devil and his angels. That's what that half hour of silence. You know why it's quiet in heaven? Because for a half hour, instead of the angels unceasingly praising God before his throne, they're involved in a war. That's why it's silent. See, most people don't get that. They go, half hour of silence in heaven. Well, if you'd understand, if you went up to heaven, it wouldn't be quiet up there. You'd have a company of angels, you'd have those cherubs around the throne, and you'd have these people that would be singing praises to God and talking about him. But do you do that when you're fighting? No, you got a half hour battle.
So we'd be watching.
Yeah, we'll watch it. We'll see it happen. We're going to watch. We're going to watch. You're going to get to watch spirit beings fight. And you're going to understand things that Frank Peretti doesn't get. And I'm saying that because he wrote that book where he had angels taking swords and cutting demons' heads off and oozing black ooze and stuff like that. And I don't know where you get that stuff. That's fiction. So, 12:1-5, to fill this in then. The 12:1-5 is the birth and life of Christ. Okay. Birth and life of Christ. Yeah, it's that box there that the arrow is that the arrow goes over to. Okay. Then to the right of that box it says 12:6. And we have the woman in parentheses Israel in the desert for 1260 days. Okay. Woman. And then I would maybe put in parentheses Israel. And then after that, in the desert for 1260 days.
This is when they're protected?
That's they're protected. Divinely protected. What? I don't know. There's a lot of people that suspect it's Petra, but in reality, we don't know.
Okay, I'm a little confused why we have that in the middle. Because there's 3.5 years and 3.5 years.
Well, it could be in the last half because they because there's the battle that's actually at the midpoint, and it's actually but the thing is verse 6 tells us where it happens. So yeah, it's really the last half.
Okay.
Yeah.
So.
But they begin fleeing here at this point. Yeah. So I agree.
Okay.
That could be drawn more accurately. Then underneath that you have 12:7-12. Okay, then we have 12:7-12, and that simply tells us that there's a war in heaven.
So are they fleeing while they're warring?
No, they're not fleeing while they're warring because they don't flee until they see Satan is cast out of heaven and he pursues them.
So
that's
the
when they begin to
flee. So the war happens first, actually, so that 12:6 should really be over here.
It could be, yeah. Yeah, that would be more accurate, I agree. Mm-hmm. It would be more accurate for the 12:6 to be over here.
Well,
yeah,
because the war in heaven happens, and then the woman or Israel
exactly,
flees, and they're in the desert for 3.5 years.
Yes,
because the midpoint is just here, and it's 3.5.
Right,
3.5.
Yeah, and the midpoint is technically a half hour long. So the seventh trumpet is here because it's the and it's the second
the
coming. It's the second coming.
Well, I'm kind of interested that is the war in heaven.
No, that's not the war in heaven.
No,
that's not the war. That's the war at the end when Christ comes back. Then 12, so 12:7-12 is the war in heaven. Then 12.
Did you say it was also the seventh trumpet?
No.
See?
Oh, I did.
You did.
What'd you
say? That 11:15.
11:15 is the seventh trumpet, and the second coming.
And you said the seventh
third
trumpet was the war in heaven.
Oh. Okay.
What was?
I didn't hear that. The
misspoke.
Okay, it's not. No, no. It's 11:15 should be seventh trumpet and the second coming. Okay. Now we come to 12:13 through 17, and we have Satan cast out.
Huh?
12:13 through 17, we have Satan cast out. So, or you could put Satan on the earth. He's not allowed into heaven, one way or another. That's what you have in the last half. And that
Satan grounded.
Satan grounded. Okay, there you go.
That's a 3.5 year.
And that's for 3.5 years, yeah. That's because it's tied with the time that the woman is protected from him.
Is the indwelling of the man of lawlessness immediate? When Satan indwells the beast.
Is that immediate? Oh, at that point? Yeah, I'm going to have to deal with that one later. Now we come to chapter 13. And that starts all the way back over on the left-hand side of your page again. 13, 1 through 4. And it says 13, and it says, "And I saw out of the sea, I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads upon his horns and 10 diadems on his heads, and the names of blasphemy." And what you're gonna, what you have introduced, very simple terms, in 13, 1 through 4, is you have the beast from the Gentiles. That's why he comes out of the sea. Because the sea, a couple of times in Revelation, is connected with the mass of humanity, the Gentiles, distinct from Israel. Okay. So it tells you where the beast comes. The beast rises up out of the Gentile nations, is where he comes from. Okay.
So what is
it? It's the beast. I would put the beast from the from Gentiles, or from the Gentiles.
I thought he was a Jew.
No.
False prophet is a Jew. And then if you look down in verse 13:5, it says, "It was given to it a mouth saying great things, blasphemies, and it was given to it authority to act for," notice this now, 42 months. Now what are the 42 months? That's again
3.5 years.
That's the last half of the tribulation, and that goes over on the right-hand side where you have 13:5 through 10. You can put the beast blasphemes, and you can put the beast rules alone. I don't know if rules alone is perfect, but essentially, just to give you a summary of what's going on that line, 13:1 through 4, you have the introduction of the beast. And in the overall picture that can be put together, the beast, when he comes to power, he doesn't come to power all by himself. He's actually among 10 other kings. And he's going to actually destroy 3 of those kings, and he's going to rule with 7 of them for a while, but eventually, in the last half of the tribulation, he will rule alone. Those 7 kings will give him their authority, okay, in the end.
Isn't 13:6 at the minute, though?
13:6, "And opened his mouth that blasphemies against God." Yeah, it is. It is at that point, technically. I just don't have it kind of connected in there. Because I'm looking at, because it says he has 42 months. So I was looking at it as the last half of the tribulation. Remember that midpoint's a half hour long.
Yeah,
so
it's kind of combined.
Yeah. Now if you look down in 13:11, and it says, "And I saw another beast coming up out of the earth." See, the first beast comes up out of the sea. Verse 11, we have a beast coming up out of the earth. And this is the second beast, and he's from the Jews, from the nation of Israel.
That's because of the earth, because the earth is promised to.
And I think it also has a connection back in chapter 12, where you have the woman that is clothed, the sun and her moon. She's clothed at the sun and then the moon under her feet. In other words, she, Israel, has that connection with being the earth. What has the sun and the moon like that? Well, the earth itself, the focus of God's focus is not everything else in reality, but this earth at the present time. And then if you look in verse 15, it says, what you end up having in beginning in verse 15 is it says, "And it was given to it to give the spirit to the image of the beast, in order that the image of the beast should speak and should cause as many as do not worship the image of the beast to be killed." And we'll go through and deal with that. That happens in the last half. In other words, when simultaneous with the first beast entering into a stage of great blasphemy, right above that in 13:5 through 10, 13:15 through 18, the second beast, in what I put down, second beast enforces worship of first. And he does it by making the image speak, causing all those who don't worship the beast to be killed. I mean, there's a lot of details in there. How do you squeeze all that? So we're trying to... Yes. Second beast enforces worship of the first.
That was under 11 through 14.
15 through 8, 13, 15 through 18. Yeah, 11 through 14 is the second beast from Jews.
So the rising up of the beast, it takes a while, and then it's the second half of the tribulation that they manifest their true identity.
Which is why the second half is called the Great Tribulation. Yeah, it's really severe.
Sorry, Tim. 15 to 18, the second beast
enforces worship of the first.
Okay, so it's the Gentile beast.
So there, yeah, he's the one that's worshipped. The Jewish beast is the fault, is the prophet that causes the first beast to be worshipped. And he does signs before the first beast and things like that in front of him for people to see. And we'll go through that in detail. I believe they both are satanically empowered. In fact, a lot of people look at the beast, the second beast, and Satan himself. A lot of people refer to that as what they call the satanic trinity. In other words, they look at, or the other way to look at it is, the beast is Satan's answer to Christ, and the second beast is his answer perhaps to John the Baptist or to Elijah.
But if Satan's not omnipresent, I just wonder how that works.
Well, he could have other demons indwelling or empowering the other. Yeah, exactly. I think he's empowering beast number one. And he probably has demons that are maybe carrying out work in the second.
Maybe reading Left Behind series.
Oh. Have I?
Have you?
No.
They name Vice President Karpov. What's the second beast? This Leo Fortunato. Anyway.
And if you turn to chapter 14, verses 1 through 5, and it says, "And I saw, and behold, the Lamb having taken his stand on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000 having his name and the name of their father having been written on their foreheads." We've already met those guys earlier. And we have the song in verse 3, "And they sing a new song before the throne, before the four living beings and the elders, and no one's able to learn the song except the 144,000 purchased." So verses 1 through 4, we simply have, I have down the song of the 144,000, or 144K, if you want to.
The Lamb is on Mount Zion.
That's right.
So is Mount Zion in heaven?
Okay, and that's why while I have that in the last half of the tribulation, I believe that it actually, I have that line extending out past there, because I believe that what we're seeing is this is a jump ahead to the millennial kingdom here at this point, looking at the fact that these 144,000 are divinely protected, and you're going to see that they're going to come out and sing a song that they're redeemed, a song that can't be matched. Okay? Then if you look in chapter 14, beginning with verse 6, and it says, "And I saw another angel flying in mid-heaven, given an eternal gospel to evangelize or to preach to the ones that are sitting on the earth and to every nation, tribe, tongue, and people, saying with a loud voice, fear God and give him the glory, because the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him, the one that made heaven and earth and the sea and the fountains of the earth." And what you have when you have this angel in these verses announcing this good news, and I actually have that all summarized, 14:6 through 20, all of this is talking about the preparation for the second coming. In other words, everything going on in chapter 14 is looking at the very end of the Daniel 70th week and the very beginning of the millennial kingdom. And when you're looking at verse 6, you have this angel, and he covers the whole earth, and he's going to tell everybody. Everybody on the earth is going to be given a warning by this angel. Everybody's going to hear him. Give glory to God. The hour of his judgment is coming. In other words, there's no one on this earth that's going to get caught without having heard that judgment is just over the horizon. They're all going to hear it from this angel. They're not going to hear it from a person on the earth. They're going to hear it from a spirit being. And then what you have following is you have another angel crying out. He tells them, get ready, because God's wrath is ready. It's time to trample. It's time to pay them back. It's time to put the sickle in and take the harvest and throw them into the wine press and trample them. And it's all this very vivid picture of what he's getting ready to do when he, at this point, when he's ready to trample them. And notice what it says in verse 20, because you can see that this is the end of the end of Daniel's 70th week. And it says, and the wine press was trodden outside the city. It's not trodden in Jerusalem. Jerusalem, there's an earthquake. But the wine press is trodden outside the city, and the blood came out from the wine press up to the bridle of the horses. Now, I've read commentaries where they go, oh, that can't happen. Listen, if you've got 200 million men gathered in that valley, and Jesus, with the word out of his mouth, literally causes the flesh on their bones to just melt off. And he's going to do that. He's going to slay them in such a way that literally their flesh and everything is just going to fall right off the bone. You can imagine what a mess that valley is going to be. And I don't think God's necessarily speaking hyperbole. I think when he says it's going to stand up that high, and notice what it says, it's going to be up to the bridle of the horse. And we're not talking about a little valley here. We're talking about a valley where it goes from 1,600 stadia, which is somewhere between 180 to 200 miles in length. That's a lot of blood. But remember, we're talking 200 million men. That's a lot of people.
And am I mistaken, but is that good news?
Is that good?
But it says there in verse 6 that's a good news.
Because that's the judge. And I think that's important that you have that song of the 144,000, because remember, the 144,000, while they survived the tribulation, it doesn't mean it was easy going. Their lives were rough. Some of them, remember, those are the people that Jesus says over in the book of Matthew, I was naked and you clothed me. I was thirsty and you gave me a drink. I was hungry and you gave me something to eat. I was in prison. That's the 144,000 that he's talking about there. That's not talking about people you run into today. That's talking about the 144,000 out there in the kingdom. So their lives, it's tough. Now, 15, turn to chapter 15. Oh, I just have the angel with the good news. I mean, I don't know how else to summarize that. Angel announces final judgment. We could put it that way, too.
The good news of Christ's coming judgment.
There you go. There's a good way to hear that. Good news of Christ's coming judgment. That'd be another way to summarize that.
Who's it good to?
Saints.
Yeah, all the Gentiles on the earth. It's good for the protected woman. It's good for the 144,000.
Yeah, it's almost over.
Yeah, it's almost over. Yeah, that's really what he's saying. Yeah, it's almost done. Just a little bit more. Okay. Now, if you go down to chapter 15 in verse 1, and it says, I saw another sign in heaven, great and marvelous, seven angels having the seven last plagues, because in them the wrath of God is completed, or it is finished. In other words, there's no wrath after those. There's no wrath from God after those seven bowls are poured out. Keep that in mind. Everybody that goes to the lake of fire is judged by Jesus Christ with just righteous, truthful judgment. There's no wrath. In other words, it's the difference between a judge sitting at his bar and lowering his gavel, and he says, "The verdict is, and this is what the this is the penalty." Versus a judge that is fuming and is yelling his head off at the convicted, because that's fury. That's what wrath is. We can play it down and we can try to make it noble, but what it is, it's fury. And what he's saying is, God is furious. He's furious with a lot of people, and he's furious with Satan and his system, and this is God pouring out his fury. In fact, the Old Testament word for fury actually had to do with heat in the nose. You get the picture? It was a very vivid, very picturesque word for God's fury over there. And we'll go through and deal with this, but really what you have, 15:1 through 16:21, is we actually have the seven bowls of wrath. Actually, 3 through 4, I've actually got two things in there. 3 through 4, we have the Song of the Redeemed. And then...
Now, my Bible, instead of calling it bowls, is calling it plagues. Why does it
mean? They are plagues. They're the seven last plagues. But if you go over to verse 1, it says you have the bowls, the seven bowls. And I'm
15:1?
16:1. They're called bowls. But also, let me look. I'm going to have to go look at it. See, I don't have all my notes here for all these things tonight, but somewhere we actually have it's the seven bowls that are filled with the seven last plagues. So we have a couple versions. You have to kind of piece all the details together. But that's what 15:1 through 16:21 is technically the seven bowls of judgment. And interestingly enough, it starts with the Song of the Redeemed.
That's 3 and 4.
3 and 4, yeah, they sing the Song of the Redeemed. And their song of the redeemed actually is a song about God being righteous and what he's going to do. He's about ready to pour out judgment, and the redeemed are going, you know what? You are righteous and you are faithful to do that. What you're going to do, the judgment you're going to pour out, that's what they deserve, and you're righteous to do it. So. And actually, 16, all of chapter 16 is technically the plagues. That delineates the plagues in chapter 16. Okay. Because if you
seven bowls, which equals the plague.
That's right. Because if you read the rest of chapter 15 after 3 and 4, if you read those, what you have is you actually have smoke and lightning and things that fill the temple of God, and everybody has to leave the temple of God until the wrath is poured out and finished. Because it just gets God so intense and his fury is... It's one of those things, if the judge were really fuming in the courtroom, you might have people that would want to leave the courtroom until he was done fuming. Well, that's what happens here. And it kind of, you see that. We'll look at it in more detail when we get there, but it's interesting. It talks about that the doors, no one can go in during that time because God is so furious. And then, chapter 17. Now, chapter 17 backs all the way up to this. And it technically, if you wanted to be real honest, chapter 17... could even impart some of this. Parts of this could even extend back through the time that the church is here, because what we have in chapter 17 through 18 is we have the history of Mystery Babylon. I would put that over on the left-hand side. History of Mystery Babylon. Right here. Right where it says 17 through 18. And over on the right-hand side, you'd have destruction of Mystery Babylon, because it's stretched out between the two chapters. Okay. But this Mystery Babylon has a history that extends all through the tribulation, though its destruction is only towards the end. But it also has a history that extends back before the tribulation begins. And one of the...
Isn't this the world system? So thus it start from when Canaan...
No. No, this is Mystery Babylon. It's called Mystery Babylon because it's not Babylon. It's a different, it has something similar to Babylon. What it is Rome, in simple terms, because he tells you it's a place that is on seven mountains, seven hills. Readers of this in the first century reading this said, oh, it is, because it's two things. It says it's on seven mountains, and they go, and John says, the seven mountains are where it is, and it is also seven kings. So the seven mountains represent two things in that context. And the seven mountains, if you would have been a first century person in Asia Minor, one of those seven churches, reading this letter from John, and he wrote about an entity that existed on seven mountains, you would have gone, let's talk about Rome. Because what was Rome called? The city on seven hills. The city on seven hills. Okay. What it was, and it that so this is the dismantling of that Roman system, okay. And I'm not saying Roman Catholicism specifically, although Roman Catholicism is part of that system. And it, a lot of that system is going to be built out of what has been Roman Catholicism throughout its history. But over on the left-hand side then, under 17 through 18, we have 17:6, 18:20, and 24. And I just want to read those three verses. Look with them in your Bible, 17:6. And it says, "If I saw the woman being drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the witnesses of Jesus, and I marveled, having seen her with great wonder," or great surprise. So we know she's responsible for the death of saints. Turn to chapter 18. Turn to chapter 18, look at verse 20. "Rejoice over her heaven, and the saints, and the apostles." Now when you're talking about apostles, where are you at?
Church.
You're in the church, because that's where the apostles and the prophets, who do you think the prophets are? Probably also the church, because remember the apostles and prophets were the ones that laid the foundation for the church according to Ephesians, because the because God has judged your judgment against her. Now we'll explain that in greater detail when we get there, but the gist of it is she is responsible in part or in whole for what happened to the saints, the apostles, and the prophets. Every one of the apostles was put to death with the exception of John, the guy writing this letter. Every one of them was put to death for their faith. And not accidentally put to death. Then look again and chat in verse 24. "And in her the blood of the prophets and the saints was found, all those having been slain upon the earth." And again, when we say that, when it says all those slain upon the earth, we're not talking about every last saint that ever died, because if you had a saint that went off to fight in World War II and they were killed in the war fighting as a soldier, they didn't die as a saint. He's talking about those that bled as saints in this country. In other words, they died because they were believers. Okay? That's what he's referring to. So, that's what's going on there. Then we have this last thing, and this all of this last box technically is out on the end, but I didn't have room for it. So, I said it's responsible for the death of saints. I'm sorry. Responsible for the death of saints. You could put Babylon, responsible for the death of saints. Because the first part says history of mystery Babylon, and then underneath there, clarification, responsible for the death of saints. That's why I put it over there. Because that's part of her history, is that she's responsible for saints being put to death. As saints. This entity has given rise to this. But we're going to explain, it's more than just Roman Catholicism. Because some people, that's all they want this to be, but this is a bigger issue than that. But that has been, think about that, since the church began, that has been the church's biggest problem since it began was Rome. First with the secular Roman Empire, and then what eventually became religious Roman Empire.
Do you know how the Catholic Church interprets the mystery of Babylon?
Thing is, I think most of the Catholic Church there are all allegorists, so they don't take most of this stuff literally anyway in here.
Aren't they not supposed to read Revelation or something?
I couldn't tell you that. Now that box down there in the bottom corner, all of that occurs after the tribulation, because in chapters 19, 7 through 9, we have the marriage of the Lamb. Yeah, is the light still on? Thank you. We have the marriage of the Lamb, chapter beginning with verse 7. It says, "Let us rejoice and let us be glad and give glory to Him for the wedding," and technically it's a wedding supper of the Lamb, because the term gamos can refer to both the marriage itself as well as to the celebratory meal following. Okay, so we have the marriage supper is what it is. And then chapters 19, 11 and following, it says, "And I saw heaven having been opened, and behold a white horse, and the one sitting on it being called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he judges and makes war." And we have the second coming in verses 11 through 21. So those all are things that are taking place right there at the very end and going out. Second coming. 7 through 9 is marriage supper. Or marriage ceremony, or marriage celebration, you might say. And then 19, 11 through 21 is the second coming. Okay. Now, if you have that, you know, what this does is this provides you kind of an overview of how this book falls and how, and what we've tried to do is show you that here at the outset, before we start getting into these last chapters, how not everything goes strictly from point A, B, C, D, E, all the way to the end. But you can see if you begin to compare things, and you have time references such as 3.5 years or 1,260 days, and we have these time references that we coordinate these things. We're able to compare these. You can see how the book's laid out. We're not trying to put constraints on it that aren't there. We're just following the cues that God's left us so that we can understand this. I don't think God gave us the book expecting us necessarily to try to sit and chart it out, but I think charting it out does at least give us a point of reference to help us kind of see where this is going. And that's why God tells us. I mean, why else would God say 1,260 days if he didn't expect us to be able to figure out, oh, he's talking about this time rather than that time? Talk about something specific, something that we ought to have some familiarity with. And so that's been our goal tonight. And I know this has been a fast, this has been a blitz. We have run through this tonight. But it's hopefully a good overview of what we're going to see in the weeks to come as we begin kind of taking this next part of the book apart piece by piece. We took kind of a fast walk through the forest. Now we're going to go back to chapter 6. We're going to start looking at the individual trees. Okay. Any questions? Did y'all stay with me tonight? Yeah. Okay. Nobody fell asleep, I see. That's good. Even those people that might have good reason to. Let's have a word of prayer and we'll close. Our Father, we are thankful for the